We'll go ahead and start with, I guess we can't go on agenda minutes either. Okay, we'll skip item two. We'll go to the wildlife board update. Conservation permit rule had quite a bit of discussion at the board meeting.
Got a problem here, it looks like.
Mike, if I forget something here, feel free to pipe in. There was a lot of concern that not only limited entry, but once in a lifetime, it gets adjusted on an annual basis, and limited entry did on the number of conservation permits. The board felt pretty strong that limited entry should be. It was brought out that most limited entry units have over 150 permits anyway, so and it maxes out at 8 permits after 150. So, but they did request limited entry to be looked at on an annual basis for conservation permit rule basis. Passed unanimously. The Northern Region wanted cowbirds added to it, but it was passed as presented, I believe. I don't remember. I don't think they included the cowbirds. The deer management plan passed unanimously. Health management plan, there was a motion to amend the DWR plan to accept to have the numbers stay as they were. That motion was defeated, and the original motion to accept DWR's recommendation for the health management plan passed. And then the fair reservoir treatment passed unanimously as well. And this is Bill or Mike? Okay. We'll go ahead and go to the regional update then.
I guess these microphones aren't working, are they?
You know, they worked before.
Yours is working.
I don't know what's happened.
Switch one.
Maybe you can switch this one over to Darius.
Mine is.
Maybe we'll have to. I'll move over to this side.
Yes, this one works.
Okay.
These two are working. Small amount.
I don't think we picked up that before.
We could just. Now, if we didn't have any sound at all, we could call this the Keystone Cops. I feel really weird standing in front of everybody, so I'm going to stand here off the side. Well, there's Charlie. Hey, we're going to have a quorum tonight.
I wait later than ever.
Yeah, glad to have you here, Charlie. You're right in time for the regional update.
I found him kind of stuck out in the mall.
Glad to have you. And Daryl's on the way, so we're going to have a quorum, and it's going to be all right. Okay, I guess I don't know if I need to apologize or what, but I actually got a complaint a couple of months ago when we had the big game rack. I decided not to do a regional update, and I received a scathing letter from one member of the public who told me that the reason they came to the rack meeting was for the regional update. So I've got one here tonight. And hopefully it's got some good things in it.
Hopefully you don't get a letter forever.
Yeah, for having one. Okay, we've got a lot of news and to talk about, and I wish Kevin was here tonight, Kevin Albrecht, because he works for the Forest Service and he's been very involved in the Sealy Fire. All of you probably know that we had a fire up in Carbon and Emery counties called the Sealy Fire that burned almost 48,000 acres, basically burned from Huntington Canyon north almost to Clear Creek, from Electric Lake over to the front out by the Gordon Creek Wildlife Management Area. It's now 100% contained, but it's still burning in spots. But it's basically under control. Of those 48,000 acres, 14,000 plus burned hot to moderate, which means that they may have to be reseeded, where most of the fire burned cool burn, just kind of in a mosaic, and it's actually going to be really fantastic for big game in particular, but a lot of species of wildlife. We had a lot of beetle-killed conifers that were burned out of the area, and it's kind of hard to see, but in that lower picture on the right, it kind of shows that even where the fire burned, where it's really dark is in the conifers, and it burned the conifers, but it left the aspen, which is exactly what we wanted it to do. And on the picture on the left right there, you can see that it's already starting to green up. You know, we've had some good moisture, a lot of rains, and last time we went out, some of the grasses were already, you know, 4 to 6 inches long. I suspect that fairly soon the oak and the aspen will start, and maybe even this fall we're going to have some forage. You know, it's not going to be a lot this year, but by next spring it ought to be really fantastic. So a lot of good things came out of this fire. We've been talking, I've been meeting with the BEAR team, the BURN, I can't even remember what it stands for, but it's the team that gets together after the fire, and they look at reclamation that needs to be done. And some things are really worried about, is access. There's a lot of baggage or problems that come with a fire, and one of those is a flash floods, and we'll talk more about flash floods in a minute, and just safety for people in the area. So a lot of those campgrounds, especially in Huntington Canyon, which are very popular, are going to be closed for the next 3 years. We've been talking about some hunting areas, in that 50,000 acres. Some of the trails and roads are closed. The Nuck Woodard Road will not be open. We'll talk. I might even have a picture of that, but I don't think we got a picture in it. But it flooded in there, and they just can't get it open this year. A lot of the trails, there's the footbridge that goes across. Fairly close to Engineer or Horse Canyon or somewhere right there in Huntington Canyon and goes up onto Candlin Mountain. The Forest Service has a priority of areas that they're going to look at first, and they're going to try to open those really popular trails. And what they'll be looking for is, can people access them and not, be in danger? And so what we're going to do is work with them to prioritize areas for them to clear, and we'll try to get some areas cleared. So the question people have been asking, well, I drew a limited entry bull elk permit. Can I turn it in? Well, the answer is they can turn it in. I think 2 years ago, the Wildlife Board passed a rule that allows them up to 30 days prior to the season to turn that permit back in. And they can get all their money back and their bonus points, but except for $25. And the other side of that question is, should they turn it in? And I would say absolutely not. Castle Valley Ridge, Trough Springs Ridge, some of the areas we thought might be most heavily impacted. I mean, there's going to be deer and elk there right now without even, worrying about green up because it burned in a mosaic. There is just plenty of habitat. There's like a million acres of elk habitat on the Manti, and we burned 50,000. There's no reason to turn in a permit. Now, this is a little bit more pertinent for people on the Oak Creek unit, where that unit burned about over 50%, anyway, of the unit, of the deer habitat in that unit burned. And so that was, we considered, should we actually close that unit? And again, the answer came back, no. A person, if they want to, can turn their permit back in. But to be honest with you, a lot of people have been seeing some really big bucks in particular, and they don't want to close. They drew a permit and they want to go hunt. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. if a person wants to hunt, they still can. If not, they can get their money back and get their bonus points back. So anyway, I hope that answers your questions there from a threshold standpoint. The other thing is we had some rumors of massive numbers of elk that had been burned. They just turned out to be rumors. We have seen no documented observations of major mortality. Obviously, there were some that died, but there's not any catastrophic losses that we're aware of. So, okay, from the aquatic standpoint, it's been a lot worse. Just as the fire was, they were getting it contained about the week before, we had a fairly large storm. You know, it's not that big of a storm. It was a 2-year and 10-minute storm. So, I mean, every 2 years and 10 minutes, you have a storm that big. Hello, Daryl. Glad to have you. And what it means, basically, they had about an inch of rain in 28 minutes. So every 2 years, you would expect a storm of that size. And that's not a very big storm, but it was catastrophic. We got major flooding in Huntington Canyon, came down the side canyon, South Hughes, Engineer Canyon, Nuck Woodard, and then over on the other side, Corner Canyon, and just massive amounts of scouring and ash into the stream. We've basically lost all of the fish from South Hughes Canyon down to the Green River. That includes, you know, down below Mounds and Wellington, you know, all the sensitive species and everything down there as well. Justin Hart went out this last week in Huntington Canyon. They did some fish surveys and they found no fish at all. We've had bluehead suckers that we found that are dead down in the lower Price River. So it's pretty catastrophic. The good news is, though, up above the right-hand fork of Huntington, we didn't get the storms up there, even though the hillsides had burned, and there's still fish there. There's still fish up above Electric Lake. And so we feel good, and actually above South Hughes Canyon, there's fish above where the flooding was, and so that's going to really help with repopulating the stream as soon as, you know, conditions improve. This one bad thing is scouring has been really bad. For instance, in Corner Canyon, there are head cuttings, you know, the stream banks have cut like 18 feet. So it's pretty catastrophic. So, I mean, this is what happens after fires, and this is one of the reasons they're having, you know, all the concerns about human safety. Here's just, I don't know if we need to read this, but this is kind of Calvin Black is our assistant aquatics manager, and he went down and looked for fish right after the storm, and this is kind of his synopsis right there. But basically, the things we found after he did this was even worse than he originally thought. Maybe it makes it easier for reestablishing Colorado River cutthroat or something. There might be a silver lining there, but it is something we can probably restore within the next couple of years anyway. But Huntington Creek is a really popular fishery, and it's a loss for us right now. But the aquatic section, moving on to what they've been doing, they had their spawning trap up at Duck Fork, collecting Colorado River cutthroat eggs, and they gathered around 38,000 eggs, which is more than they need. That program is going really well, and along with that, they did the second treatment on Farron Reservoir. The Forest Service came up and helped us with that, and we've had absolutely no fish that we found the second time, so we had a complete kill on the first treatment, and they were able to restock the reservoir with cutthroats and triploid rainbows, which means they're sterile, and brook trout before the 4th of July, and fishing's good. So things are going well at Farron Reservoir. Moving on, what we're going to do from that point on with the aquatic section is they're going to move over into some of the other drainages, and they're going to be treating those in the next couple of years. Brent has been busy with fishing events. We had the special needs fishing event at the Gelati Pond. I think we had about 140 people that attended that, and we fortunately just put in some brood stock from one of the hatcheries, and so we had the special needs kids were catching 4- and 5-pound trout, and they were really tickled with that. So, and then we had Another one out at the Carbon County Pond. Is that right, Brent? Yeah. And we had good participation there and really good fishing success. The Sunnyside Bighorn Sheep Watch was on the 6th of, or 16th of December, or June, wrong 12 or 6, whatever. I'm a little dyslexic there, but I guess we had quite a few people, but we didn't see a lot of sheep, did we, Brent?
You know, we had about 23 eventually.
Okay. If anybody wants to go and see bighorn sheep still, I drove up there last Thursday and they were right on the road, right there in front of the traders, the miners' trading post, and couldn't get them out of the road. So they're around. And then Tony Wright and Brent went and did a Meet the Bats night on the 21st of July over at the Rio Grande Mesa Center. And they had about between 40 and 50 people that showed up. But the only problem was before midnight, they only caught 3 bats. But then after midnight, when there's only a couple of people left, they caught about 10 more or something. So we'll invite the bats a little earlier next year. Okay, let's see. Law enforcement's been busy. They just had another checkpoint up on I-70, and we were surprised, really. We've done 2 of those now. They contacted 215 persons. 84 vessels were inspected this time. They decontaminated 4 boats, but we didn't write any citations. But we did have something pretty cool. Got a call from somebody. Said, hey, somebody's coming up Highway 6 pulling this big sailboat. You probably ought to take a look at it. So Mike Belinsky and one of our officers ran down there. And it was the guy at that time was almost to Walker's in Wellington, pulled over this boat, and there were mussels on the boat. So we seized this boat, and we had it in our yard there for about 2 weeks, and we decontaminated. It was really tough to decontaminate because it had like bilge pumps everywhere and had like 4 or 6 different tanks inside, and it was pretty difficult to get everything cleaned out, but we did, and didn't issue a citation on that. The owner was very cooperative, came and helped us do it, and we got the boat cleaned and sent him on his way. He was taking the boat from Texas to Washington, and we feel we got it taken care of, and it turned out really well. Now, a lot of us had visions of grandeur. I thought, man, I'm going to sell my house and buy one of these sailboats. I think it costs like $1.2 million, so I better get a job with the Nature Conservancy if I'm going to do that. We had Stacy had a really good case. Her and JD, I believe it was, working up on Range Creek up by the Nutter Ranch, and they got a tip on somebody flying around in a helicopter and went out there, and this guy was using a helicopter to collect sheds in a WSA and on private property. So we made a case on that. It was quite interesting. Habitat section. Range Creek had a fire, so we're going to help reseed that. It was only about close to 800 acres. It should be very beneficial. We had plans to do another fire up at Cold Springs in our wildlife management area, but with all the other fires going on and, the dry conditions this year, we couldn't pull it off, so we're going to try to do that next year. Wildlife section today, Wade and Brad are over on the Henrys trying to fly, do the bison survey. It rained really hard there today, so maybe they'll be doing it tomorrow. They've also been classifying elk and had some bear complaints, and we've had some quite a few depredation issues already. Something I wanted to make everybody aware of tonight is because of the drought conditions, things are really dry statewide. We've had the recent rains down here in southern Utah the last couple of weeks that has really helped. And I'm probably going to ask Pam maybe for an update. I don't know if you want to do it in front of everybody or just later on, but we're really concerned that a lot of the permittees, the Forest Service is already indicating that some are going to be asked to go home early. And Price, the BLM, said that there are some allotments they may not let people go out on. We are sensitive to that, and so we have looked at different places in the state where maybe we have more elk than we want to, given the range conditions we have right now. And so Jim has emergency powers, you know, as a director, he has emergency powers. And this does not need to go through the RAC process, but what he's going to do is instead just take to the Wildlife Board on the 16th of August. And we're going to ask for some additional antlerless elk permits. And we're asking for some early, August 1st to the 18th. And I guess we don't have anything going yet, do we?
No, nothing. Not our region.
Okay. Yeah, we may do some, you know, in the southern region they were going to do some early before the Wildlife Board met, and Jim could just do that under his emergency authority, and what we would have done is just had a depredation hunter pool and just drawn those in the regional office and called people and asked if they wanted to come and hunt. But I don't think any of those have been authorized yet. They were proposed for the Beaver, the Monroe, and the Southwest Desert. What we've asked for, though, is in the general season, I don't have all the units listed, but I think there's about 15 units statewide that where we're asking for additional permits, and we're asking for 50 more on the La Salles and 60 additional on the San Juan. And I'm not sure yet how those are going to be allocated, if they're going to be first come, first serve over the counter, or if we're going to use...
Yeah, that's
go ahead.
Yeah, depending on how many we have on all the various units, that's probably the best way to do it instead of going through all the alternate list. They just go for sale over the counter. And this is more, and I think Bill alluded to this is more of just a heads up more than anything. The numbers that we're giving you, 50 and 60, that's where we stand right now, and that's probably what we're going to recommend. Every wildlife manager in the various regions come August 13th are going to give a final recommendation, but right now there's about 15 or so that units that biologists and managers are looking at, and some of that's subject to change, but that's kind of the idea.
And we have the option too for some more late season permits, but we're going to wait and see what happens with the rains and everything. The Forest Service always already asked us to consider more permits on the North Manti with the fire, so we will look at that later on, and we can come back and tell you if we do anything extra there. But they will be voting on it. I don't know if they're going to vote on it or just discuss it at the Wildlife Board, but I wanted to make you aware of that for right now. There is a chance we'll also have some additional cow bison permits on the Henry Mountains. We'll wait and see what we come up with during the survey. And also, again, you know, we've been getting quite a bit of rain, and typically when you get these late summer rains, you get a lot of the gaieta grass down on the desert greens up, and so it may not be so critical now, but we'll watch rain conditions, and that may we may come back with something there. The last thing I want to talk about tonight was you may have heard we have a predator management program, the Mule Deer Protection Act, and actually John Shivik is here, and he knows more about that than anybody else. So I'm going to turn that over to him, but while he's getting his ready, just go ahead and minimize it, yeah. And do you guys have any questions on anything in the region, or anything I've talked about?
The eggs they took from Duck Fork, the 38,000, is that the usual number, more or less? Where were you? About half?
Mm-hmm. But it's more than they targeted. It's more than their goal. Had a goal, I think, of about 24,000, but a couple of years ago they had like 47,000. So it's less than the last 2 years, but it's really more than they really were planning on. So it's doing fine. But they would have liked to have had more this year, but the problem is that they caught a lot of younger age cutthroat. You know, where we've been, you know, stocking them back in, those are starting to. They probably need another year before they're fully mature. So it should be better next year.
And they really put brook trout back in the Farron Reservoir?
You know, that was a surprise to me. I thought it was just triploid rainbows. And so, Brent, you put that on there.
Triploid brook trout, too.
Okay. So
probably tiger trout, then.
I don't think they put tiger trout.
No.
Mm-hmm. But they're sterile.
They're sterile. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So, again, follow up on some of the stuff in the region. This is a statewide deal, obviously, but it's going to impact what's going on here, and a lot of people have been had a lot of interest in this program. So the Predator Control Incentive Program, basically just a real quick little background on it. Utah's historically had a pretty aggressive predator management program. We've been spending more, really, than the next five states around us every year on largely deer protection. This year's big change. Everything's popped up quite a bit. We're going to be into it about 1.1 million this year. It pops it off the graph in terms of what we had been doing through the past. So there's a big bump in what's going to be going on. The way this came about, a couple bills, one of the predator control funding bill, Senator Hankins, which is the one that added the $5 fee on big game hunting licenses to fund the removal of predatory animals. Then there's a Mule Deer Protection Act, Senator Oakland sponsored, and this requires the DWR to reduce coyote populations for the benefit of mule deer. So a lot of the things about these acts, they're really keyed in. The point is the protection of mule deer. It's about mule deer, about working where mule deer are. That is the purpose of it. And what they do is they essentially authorize the DWR, instruct the DWR to remove coyotes in areas where they are a threat to deer. The way the fund's broken out, the predator control funding, $600,000 or so is going to Wildlife Services. This is going to go to direct management, the way we had been doing, working with them in the past, and you saw some of those numbers before, where we can target high elevation areas or other places that are of concern, and they can go right in and do the work. Then the other $500,000 that's left over, this is going to public contracts. This is the stuff that people are talking about. And that's divided up into two different approaches as well. Within the law, it talks about a general predator program, and it talks about a targeted predator control program. The general one is the one that's up and running right now, started July 1st. I'll talk a little bit about how we're going to implement it. But this is the one where it contracts with the general public, for people from the general public can remove coyotes, come in, and be reimbursed $50 for those animals. The targeted predator control program is a little bit different. That's using specific, what we call preferred vendors. And I think I'll talk about that a little bit more. But basically, the general is the anybody in the public. The target is where we contract the specific people for specific areas and to try to hit coyotes that way from those places. That's going to start probably in the fall of 2013. So we try to incorporate a little biology into this as well. We're recommending specific locations for removals. Again, we want people to really focus on places where where coyotes could be killing fawns, for instance. So we're trying to target people there rather than, obviously, Kansas and Nebraska and Montana and wherever else. We want them to think about this. If this program's going to work, they're going to have to remove coyotes from areas where it's going to help the deer population. Same with timing. If you want to efficiently impact the coyote population, the best time to hit them is that December, January, February, and we can take it into fawning season. The idea there is to remove them before they produce pups, but also when they're at a place where they're going to be during the fawning season. During the fall, late summer, fall, they're dispersing, they're moving around, they're dying of other causes. If you want to actually impact the coyote population on places where mule deer are, you need to try to time it the best. So we're recommending timing removals for those times. We've produced a really general map for locations. It's not very specific. This isn't a where the coyotes are and this is where you should go. This is a general deer map of the state, and we're handing this out for people to do it. Participating in the program is actually fairly easy. People do have to register first. It's going to be important to register because we need people to know where, when, and the kind of information we need to collect as we go through this program. So the registration is just a simple 10 questions that give you information that you need to have in order to turn in coyotes. People do have to produce information such as their home address, social security number. There are tax implications. They will have to be sent 1099s, for instance, if they turn in enough animals. Request for compensation, this is the guts of it, how they do it. They'll need to bring in a lower jaw plus either a scalp with the ears or the whole pelt. We want the lower jaw. So we can grab a tooth and we can get some age numbers from these guys. We also want a tissue sample because I'll be putting a genetics database together. So we'll be able to tell regions of where coyotes came from, at least to be able to check people. Again, the idea is to keep honest people honest. If they're bringing in coyotes from way out of state and they're really egregious about it, we should be able to tell that people are doing that. So we want to have that sort of information available. We want them to sign a paper saying, again, this is the GPS location where I removed this coyote from, and the date, and certify that information. The GPS locations are important for a couple reasons. Primarily, though, is we want to be able to see where we're moving coyotes from, where we're not removing coyotes from, and if there's any donut holes or missing kind of places. And that'll come into play a little later when we talk about the targeted program. There are going to be posted locations. Each region is coming up with a plan of where they will take in the coyotes in order for the reimbursements. And each region is doing a little differently. Right now, I think in this region, they've got Justin's working on three different sites or so, and it won't be every day, but it'll be Monticello maybe Tuesday from 5 to 8, and then switch over to another location on another day and another day. So it'll rotate around. It'll probably change a little look depending on what the demand is, but the idea is to never make anybody have to travel more than an hour or so. We're really trying to make it easy for people to do this. If they do everything right, which is actually easy, it's $50. We are, like I said, recommending that people wait until December to remove coyotes, but they can remove them now. They just have to register first. Then they have to hold the scalps and jaws until we're ready. We hope to be ready by September 1st or so, and as soon as we're able to put this all together, we're going to post the information up on the web at this predator. So people will be able to log in August, look at it. Oh, okay, Monticello is on Wednesday the 5th. Okay, I'll show up then. So that's the plan there. It has, there are some questions about why it's taking so long to implement it. One answer is this is a new program. Nobody's done anything this large before in any of the states that I know of. We've got $500,000 to thousands of people potentially that we have to track. So far, 2,970 people have signed up for the program. And we have state purchasing rules that we have to follow, so we need to be able to track it. We have to have a bunch of systems in order, so it isn't been just giving a wad of cash to Justin and having him, you know, send it out. And again, we try to make enough locations. And we're trying to do this without hiring any or very many new people or create very many new FTEs. We're trying to do this so all that $500,000 goes to reimbursements and not just not to hiring new people for us. The targeted predator control action probably started, as I said, in the fall of 2013. These are the approved vendors. So these are people, according to the state, if you want to sign up to be a contractor, you're going to need to show that you've removed a bunch of coyotes, that you know what you're doing, that you produce reliable information. So this first season is about people turning in coyotes, getting a track record, and then if they're good hunters and they're producing good information, then they can get into a list of approved vendors. And then we can make private contracts with them. And that's where it's going to be important when I talked about the GPS locations. If we find people are hitting certain places and missing others, then this is the pool of people we would provide contracts to find, to work coyotes in those sort of donut hole kind of areas. Okay. So finally, just a lot of the questions have to do with, is this program going to work or is it not going to work? The biology is pretty clear on it. That is, sometimes. Yeah, sometimes it doesn't. The fact is that coyotes, predators, aren't everything. Other factors impact deer. Weather and habitat are generally more important factors. And if you have a bad, you know, bad couple of winters, doesn't matter how many coyotes you remove, the deer are still going to be hit. So it's complicated. One of the other things in terms of removing coyotes, if you want to kill every coyote in Utah, you need to do for multiple years, need to remove greater than 70% of the animals over multiple years. That's a really, really difficult thing to do. That's not going to happen. So for a lot of people, I think, that are thinking we're going to have no coyotes in Utah anymore, that's not very likely. But if people are able to target specific areas where deer are of concern, they can impact populations in those small areas, and they might see something. We're hoping if we're putting all this time and effort into this, we're hoping we'll see fawn survival increased, but this is something that we don't know if it's going to work or how well it's going to work quite yet. That's why we're gathering the information. That's why we're tracking the information. And we're going to use the population data to evaluate the program and make sure we're getting everything out of it that we're putting into it, essentially. And that's just the information on the coyotes.
Anybody have any questions for John? Thanks, John. Let's back up a minute to the approval of the agenda and minutes. Can I have a motion to accept the agenda and the minutes from last?
I'll make a motion. We accept the agenda, and I'm not sure I've seen the minutes.
Thanks, Wayne.
Second.
Yeah. Perfect. Now, I assume you meant you want the minutes as well, or you say
yeah,
you haven't seen them.
Yeah, I think I saw print sent them out, but I didn't read them. yeah, but they've always been good.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. All in favor? Opposed? Unanimous. Okay, let's move on to number 5, Bobcat Harvest Recommendations. John?
It's nice to see everybody again. It's been a while. This one's going to go quite fast as well. The Bobcat permit recommendations are fairly simple and straightforward. Statewide recommendation based on numbers and based on the Bobcat plan. The Bobcat plan is a simple and straightforward plan for the most part. We just have a few different target numbers that we're looking for, and we adjust permits based on achieving those targets. So, and these are the specific performance targets. The variable proportion kittens and yearlings. So what we've done is, or the plan is, put together a target range based on the last, few decades of historical take of these animals in these proportions. And then we use that to get that average and a confidence interval around the average. So we want to be somewhere in this target range. So proportion kittens, somewhere between 0.42 and 0.56. Adult survival is calculated based on the numbers, and we want to get it in that range. Percent females, that's proportion of females, 0.41 to 0.45, and the set days per bobcat. Then the plan outlines what to do if you are in or out of those ranges. Relative to this year, what we're looking at. Yes, sir.
Before you go any further, could you sort of explain what those numbers are?
So this is take of bobcats for, this is the target range. I'll start with the next slide. How's this sound?
Okay.
So what we do is every year we'll survey the for people with the licenses and look at the and then we also collect the people bring in their bobcats. So we know how many, the ages of animals from the teeth. We know the numbers of young and yearlings versus the adults. And then we can use those numbers in order to calculate a survival rate, to come up with that survival rate right there. Then we also know what the percent females that are harvested are, and that's just the same as kittens and yearlings versus the number of adults. So it's the number of females. So 0.45 would be 45 females for every 100 males and females together. And then set days per bobcat is where we're asking how many people are out trapping for bobcat, and then how many days they set, and then how many bobcats they collected. So you just have that calculation of set days per bobcat.
So John, in the top one, if you had 35 or 0.35 proportion kittens and yearlings, that means that 35% of your harvest
are
kittens.
Yes,
and
yes, sir. Yeah, and I've realized, last night, but I can't change it now. So it is a little confusing because it's proportion kittens and yearlings out of the total take, and percent females is actually proportion females out of the total take as well. Did I clarify that?
With the adult survival.
And the adult survival, that means so you can use those those proportions to back calculate based on how many adults you're seeing, how many this year versus last year, to say, if you get an estimate of out of 100 adults that we had, say, in 2011, 70 of those 100 are still alive in 2012. And that's just an ongoing survival rate of a population. So it's just like with humans, there's a certain proportion of people that die, certain proportion of new people that are born, and then the adult survival is only that one half of that equation. So we know how many animals, an estimate of how many animals are surviving every year. Not incorporated into this is the estimate of how many animals are being born every year. I've made that much more complicated than I probably needed to. Yeah, but the survival is simple, just how many animals.
70% of the adults are expected to live next year, be alive next year.
Yeah, it just seems, I sort of understand that, but it just seems pretty sketchy to me.
It's actually really good.
Yeah, the calculations, we can go into the way it's calculated. It's actually fairly reliable. To be honest, I mean, there is a certain amount of, I mean, there's variance associated. These are estimates. In the same way, I like to explain it this way. I can't tell you exactly how many bobcats there are in the state. I can't tell you how many bears there are. I can't tell you how many cougars there are. But I can tell you, is the population going this way or is it going this way, based on the things we can measure. It's one of those things. If you want to get to St. George from here, you know, is it more useful to know the number of miles or is it more useful to know the direction? And it's kind of more useful to know the direction in terms of wildlife. And that's what we're good with the populations. We know the direction of where it's going based on these numbers, but I don't know an absolute for you. So it feels a little squishy, but it's kind of the state of the art.
John, I just might add that, you know, with this adult survival, what you have is, you know, every bobcat that's brought in, you know, somebody, they need to bring in a jaw, and the tooth is taken and sectioned, and so we have a great database that goes back clear until about 1985 from this. I mean, we have thousands of teeth that we've sectioned, thousands of bobcats we've aged, and we have confidence intervals around those that adult survival, and it's, you know, plus or minus 4 or 5-ish. Yeah. So it's really not that. It's really a pretty good estimate. It's some of the best data we have as far as population data.
The tables are pretty impressive going way back, yeah. Did that get at what your... I want to get to the bottom of it. If you...
Well, no, the other thing I have, of course, is that the set-day bobcat statistic shows that, I mean, we're still way off target range. And,
right.
And that sort of indicates to me that if they're having to set traps 400 days to sort of, and things are sort of maybe moving in the right direction, at least with kittens and yearlings, you know, but 1 year is not a great statistic. It'd been nice if we'd have seen multiple years.
But that kind of says
to me that maybe the population isn't what you think it is. If you're thinking that that's going to get you, 197 set days is going to get you what you want,
yeah,
and we're having to do 400 or 492,
right?
That tells me that there's a lot, there may be a lower population than you think there is.
There's a couple of things. Maybe it might be best to go through the recommendations, because there's a couple of things. Is one, the reliability or usefulness of each of these variables, but that's relative to the plan that we're operating under, that I can't, you know, this is a board approved plan that we follow. So I'm sensitive to the fact that some of these variables are more useful than others, but until we're at the stage where we're going to reopen the plan and rechange it around, kind of my hands are tied to following what's been agreed on based and dictated by the board. Does that make sense? But I'd be happy to give you my opinion on these different variables, but it might be easier to go through the rest of the recommendations so we can put it in context.
And then the other question I have is, if we're going to be killing off all these coyotes, we're going to need some predators, and the bobcat is the next best one, it's next best shot. Otherwise, we're going to have a lot of rats and mice and vermin around that we don't really want. And it seems to me that we're doing a double whammy to ourselves and to vegetation out there. I mean, not, I mean, if we end up with too many rabbits, too many rats, too many mice, too many squirrels, too many chipmunks, we're going to be impacting habitat for other things as well. You know, deer, elk. You know, in other words, we're going to be doing a double whammy here that makes absolutely no sense as far as I'm concerned.
On the flip side, though, if you reduce coyotes, it might actually help improve the bobcat population. I mean, it's going to take a couple of years to see how these things tease out.
Let's go ahead and get the rest of the recommendations in division, then we can...
Thank you. Okay. So I hope I've explained the variables. Again, based on that historic range that we talked about, we expect to see each one of these variables hit each one of these ranges, or for the set days per bobcat, hit that 195 average, or 197 average. This year, we didn't get there. I'll just jump ahead. The proportion of kittens and yearlings in the population, it's lower than the target than we're supposed to be at. Adult survival's right in there. Proportion of females right in there is where it's supposed to be. Set days for bobcats is much higher. So yes, you're right. There's a lot more effort being put in for each bobcat that's harvested. So that means two of these things are out of the plan. Where we're supposed to go. So in general, if any two performance targets are outside of the range, we would adjust the number of tags per individual by 1 to 2. So if we were to follow the plan, just that element of the plan, we would knock back tags 1 or 2 per individual from the current 3. But however, there's a provision in there to keep the number of tags consistent with the previous year if the variables are moving toward target ranges. Actually kind of clever, because it allows us to more incrementally adjust since this is a yearly plan. I think that's more important, or is a useful factor, that we can more incrementally adjust based on what we're seeing in terms of data. So in 2011 it was 0.31, now it's 0.35. It's moving toward survival's in range, was in range, percent females was in range, set days per bobcat is coming down actually from what it was in 2011. So since everything is moving in the right direction based on our last year's recommendations, we're going to recommend consistency with the previous year. So that is the maximum number of permits at 4,600 and a limit of 3 permits for individual. So if you, what we're recommending is that if you pull up the new fur bearer booklet, then it'll say exactly like last year, except adjusted for the season, so it starts on a Wednesday and not a Sunday, that kind of thing. So everything's the same as last year, but just adjusted for dates. So that's the recommendations for the bobcats, and we can kind of pursue some of those other things if you'd like.
Let's go ahead and have questions from the RAC first, and we'll get into discussion here in a little bit.
Once we fall into line, what would the permits be raised to? Once we come into line where everything's in indices?
The baseline is 6.
So
6 per individual.
Right,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Explain to me the set days, like 492. What, is that how many days the traps are out?
Yeah, so one trapper might set 100 traps for one day, and that's 100 set days. And yeah, so we get an average set days per trapper, and that one is an interesting metric because you have some trappers that have been working in an area they know really well, other ones that, if you look at the data, probably one of the biggest correlative factors is what the fur price was last year. So if you get a big fur price last year, a bunch of people, I want to start trapping, and they come in and their set days are terrible. They don't know what they're doing as much, so it really skews that number. So it's one of those things that you kind of keep in, you know, it's not a pure easy science. There's a little bit of art, and that's why there's those 4 different factors, and there's not any one thing that drives our recommendations completely. So it's smart that way.
Any other questions for John? John, do you feel that the increased coyote removal is going to benefit bobcats, or is it going to, you think it's not going to be enough? I guess what I'm asking is there much overlap in habitat and competition for forage?
What tends to happen, and some of these points are right, there's a lot of ideas about, it's called mesopredator release, where if you can remove certain animals, raccoons, foxes, a lot of these other things are going to, they can really kick up high after you remove a bunch of coyotes. I don't know. It depends how many people shoot bobcats that are out shooting coyotes at the same time. And, you know, there's a lot of really complicating factors there. The other thing is our rabbit populations. Your rabbits are doing good here, too, aren't they? The most of the state, they're sort of, they've been on a down, and now they're coming up. They're coming up. So even though coyotes might be removed, the bobcats might be doing well on other things. So, you know, my best guess is, we're going to have to see. I don't expect a monster jump in bobcats, but I don't see, you know, anything can kind of happen, but it's probably not going to do bad for them.
Okay. Any other questions from the rack?
I had one more. It has to do with the coyotes. So at one point, if the fawn levels increase, we continue coyote control. If we don't see an increase in fawns, how many years... You guys have a plan for that as far as how long to continue the program if it doesn't give a response, or what kind of response you're looking for?
Well, there's a variety of things mixed in now in terms of units that we're worried about and predator management plans and the whole coyote program. So the coyote program, the way it's set up, it's really relative to those laws instructing us to work with the public to remove coyotes. So I think what's going to happen is this first year we're going to see where people are removing them. Then we're going to see what our fondo ratios look like. If there are, a lot of these things are already being treated with wildlife services. They're already under predator management plans. And that whole process has several years in a row. You're looking at the numbers and you're looking at range conditions. And if they don't match up, then you're going to click things into gear in terms of looking at some of these other predators and what the problems are, either coyotes or cougars, depending on what the population is or what's being hit. So relative to the plan, I don't really have a strong answer for that until we see what happened, or not the plan, relative to the predator incentive program, we don't have a really good answer until we see what the public, what comes about from public interactions there.
No other questions from the rack. We'll open it up to questions from the public. I say you limit it to questions, hopefully just for clarification and help formulate your comment here in a minute. Question?
Yeah, question. Jerry Swayze. Some studies that they've done with coyote population in Wyoming, once they control that, some big sections of ranches that are up there, they control the number of coyotes down to where they're, you know, tolerable. The bobcat population is noticed to be rebounding, you know, almost hand in hand as one trades places with the other. So I think we probably see an increase in the cat population because they're both competing for the same rabbit. And so if we diminish the coyotes, we'll probably see the cats come up. Is that correct? And then I think with the rabbit population, we've been down for the last 2 or 3 years. And so now I think we see more rabbits increase. The amount of predators that we see will start coming. By the way, Mother Nature takes care of things, I suppose. So that's a good idea. And I think Utah Trappers Association would probably endorse that 100%.
Okay, we'll give you an opportunity for a comment here in just a minute.
Yep.
Any questions from the public? Mike? Yeah. If you don't want Brent to yell at you, you better come up there.
This is an easy one. Mike King, I'm just curious what the overall bobcat harvest was for the state last year.
I think we bobcat harvest numbers.
I think, you know, I should have that number right in front of me, but it's in like that 300 range, 500 range, but I'm going to have to double check that.
So it's 10% or less
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
With her.
Yeah. Let me check.
I was thinking it was about 1,000.
I know. I'm feeling strike that. I want to really double check that number. Any other questions from the public? Okay, we'll move to comments and suggestions from the public. The Bobcat Harvest recommendations. I have a comment card from Dan. It's semi-related to Bobcats. You want to go ahead and
do your...
Yeah.
My name's Dan Cockain. I'm a houndsman and also the line coordinator for the Utah Houndsman Association. I appreciate the opportunity to have a minute. I also appreciate John watching over these critters. He's a good guy, and we appreciate him. I emailed everyone a copy of this stuff, and I hope that you got it. If not, I brought copies, but... As my role in the Houndsman Association over the past 4 months, I've traveled all over the state talking to houndsmen, and statewide, there's a huge concern about lion populations and the female harvest. And we realize that we're in the second year of a 2-year plan, but we also think there are some things that the board could do to take some steps to keep us out of big trouble. We, and these numbers aren't absolutely 100%, but in 2011, we killed 39% females. In 2012, it looks like we're going to kill around 34%. The management plan calls the trigger at 17 to 20% females, so we're way above that. And then if we also consider... over in Montrose, they had a collared cougar study. They killed 3 females with collars that orphaned 8 kittens, and they were all euthanized to get their collars back. So if on the average these females that were killing just had a half a kitten apiece, you know, we're killing 50% females. And we think that's way out of line. I've talked to houndsmen that have been in the field 30 years, and they tell me they've never seen the lion population this low. And I understand that we've picked on them for a long time, and it hasn't changed much with the deer. The thing to consider with the houndsmen, you know, we may not be a huge group, but we have quite a financial impact with what we do. You know, when I hunt deer, I buy a box of bullets, an orange vest, a tank of gas, maybe or two to go out and scout, but that's about it. As a houndsman, I spent more money in LaSalle buying gas last bear season than I did in my own community. You know, because it's a year-round thing. We're feeding our dogs, we're training, we're doing all that, so... When we hurt the houndsmen to the point that they aren't around anymore, you know, we created a bunch of things. The other thing that we're concerned about is that the science says when the percent of females harvested goes up and the age goes down, it's a sure sign of a declining female or the declining lion population, and we're absolutely seeing that. If you kill a male lion, you kill a male lion, another one moves in and takes his place. If you kill a female lion and you take, on an average in her lifetime, she's going to have 12 kittens that survive. If half of those are females, in 3 generations, you've killed 2,000 lions. So over 2,000 lions. So it, killing females has a huge impact, which kind of brings me to the things that we feel like that we can do, even though... We pretty much all agree that the board isn't going to open the plan and change the quotas. We feel the female harvest quotas are too high. We'd rather see a low female quota and then have those harvest objective units turn to male only. It can be done. It's done in a lot of states. And we can still harvest lions and we can still have the opportunity to hunt, but we don't need to kill all the girls. Some things that we think are important, the DWR has put together an excellent cougar orientation program, and it's voluntary. It's about the only species that it is voluntary. We'd like to see it mandatory. If you have a lion tag, you have to take the course. If you're a guide, you're guiding a lion hunter, you have to take the course. If you're an outfitter, you have to take the course. And we'd also like to see that updated so that every hunter understands the impact of taking that female. When they're taking a 40-pound female, they're not taking a trophy. They're just killing something because they have a tag, and we'd like to change that. We'd also like to see the split. A lot of the units are limited entry for a certain time, then they split to a harvest objective. Anyone can come in. We'd like to see that move to the 1st of April. Typically, March is a very good month to hunt cougars. We have lots of storms and lots of opportunity. And what's happening is it's becoming a competition. So as the clock ticks towards, you're going to have all these other hunters come in, then you settle for a little young girl, and that's hurting the population. So we'd like to see that move, those dates moved. Right. The other trigger for adjusting quotas is cougars treed per day, and that's through the hunters that are just pursuing. It's another unique thing. We buy a non-consumptive tag. We spend our dollars to get nothing except maybe a picture, we hope. And that's part of what triggers adjusting those quotas. Right now we do a random survey, a voluntary random survey of, I think it's 25%, is that right, John, of the permit holders? So we'd like to see that mandatory for everybody. If you have a permit, take the 5 minutes. I did it this year. It's great information. It creates numbers there so that we can do this with good science. We have a cougar study currently on the Monroe where we're paying a houndsman to go out and catch a cougar, tranquilize it, put a collar on it, and then right now it's fair game to kill it. And I think that he was at one of our meetings, Clint Meekum was, and I think he said they killed 40% of the lions that are wearing collars. We're not studying these animals if we're killing them. The study on the ochre, you can't kill a collared cat, and we'd like to see that statewide. If we're going to spend our money to study them, to collar them, do all that, let's not kill them. And then the last thing that we would recommend is that that everyone's required to GPS the location of their kill. There was a case right down here in your country of, I don't know all the details, but I believe the lions were being killed in Colorado and tagged with Utah tags. But the way limited entry and split entry and harvest objective, it's so easy to kill a lion in one canyon and claim it on another canyon tag, and we'd like to see that. It's a law enforcement tool. It's also a biology tool, so the biologists can see where these lions are being killed, where they're taken from, and what the population is doing. I've been in the woods all my life and never seen a cougar without my dogs. They're just elusive, and it's hard to know how many we have. If you talk to the houndsman like I have, we don't have nearly what we've had ever. So we think they've been picked on way too much, and we need to quit killing the females. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. When is the cougar rotation?
Not going to be this year, is it?
So we're on the second year of a 3-year cougar. So the next round we'll be talking a lot about cougars. But we're already working with, Dan's been great and has been coming to these and bringing some of these issues up. So we'll work with him, and I think we'll have a really good set of recommendations for cougars, but we won't, it's nothing to talk about now.
Okay. Dan,
No, well, Bear just started a brand new. Right.
The cougar last year. Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah, yeah. Right. So the right. The cougar one. So we're in the second year. This is where it's gotten confusing, and I'm learning this as I go as well. So the cougar's on a 3-year plan. Last year they did change some stuff in it. Right. Exactly. So, but as you can see, that causes a lot of confusion, and it sort of undercuts the whole purpose for having a 3-year plan. And one of the big purposes of having a 3-year plan is so you can have good enough information on any given year. It's a late snow, it's an early snow, harvest has really been impacted by, you know, by all sorts of yearly things. It makes a lot of sense to me to follow these 3-year recommendations so you have a good data set, so you're making a good recommendation for what's going on, vice versa. As of right now, as relative to cougars, it wasn't on the agenda because we're getting to this point of, you know, following the 3-year plan.
Okay, I see all that. But how about something like the GPS thing you have? You're going to GPS coyotes. You have, but
I was just going to say, regardless of whether we have brought it up or not, I think the RAC is still able to make recommendations.
The fact is, I think the GPS thing is an excellent thing. I've had some of your people bring that to me because you do have all this influx from other states, and then you would know where everyone was killed. If there's something shady or something going on, you can go see if it's killed. I don't think we should change the plan either. I think that's foolish, but that's a tool that benefits these guys a whole lot.
Right.
The GPS location on a cougar.
I agree, and this is what I was saying. There's some of the things that they've come up with that I think are also, I think they're wonderful things that will work and get them incorporated in. Okay. The idea is, though, I mean, you can make recommendations on whatever now. I'm only prepared, you know, I'll be more prepared to get cougars up and running next time around, and cougars is on the plate next time around. So I fully expect some of these things to be discussed and incorporated into our recommendations and incorporated into some of your thoughts as well. So I don't know. I this public process is great. It's nice to have. What's really good about things coming up now and us having these discussions now is that the day of recommendations, I'm not playing catch up. What I'm hoping is that when we come in around next year, that we'll have, we're doing this because of this, this, and this, and because of this input, and this input, and this input. So you guys are up to speed on things relative to playing catch up. And it's going to be a good process that way. And I'll have 3 years of data, so I'll be able to make really strong recommendations about what the cougar population is doing.
How about things like GPS?
No, that's great. I think that's great. Right, right.
It doesn't affect you.
Yeah. I think that's great, but I have to admit the public process, for all of its wisdom and help, also has we get hit where people are like, what? You're watching us in GPSs, and we can't afford GPS, and, you know, it goes vice versa, and that's where we leave it up. You know, we look for your guidance to figure out how to sort this out and get that to the board so they can sort that out.
But a valuable thing might be is if you feel strongly about that, you could make a motion tonight, you know, for John to consider that for next year, and then it'll be voiced at the Wildlife Board, and it'll be something on your plate to look at. So, I mean, it's worth bringing up.
Just a quick question. How hard is it to falsify the GPS location?
No, it's not very hard.
It's easy as writing it down on a piece of paper.
You're doing something wrong.
Yeah, you know they were lying. So that would be the implication. If somebody wrote down a GPS location, because you have 48 hours to turn the cougar in to have it sealed after it's killed. So, you know, the officer could say, okay, you've got this location, let's go take a look at it. Especially if he suspects somebody. And that's probably the only time it would be used, if you suspect somebody is not, you know, hunting in the right area. And so then you go out and you look and, so then it becomes a law enforcement tool at that point. And we don't, you know,
We're good. Can I answer the question relative to bobcats still, as far as numbers? I got embarrassed by not having numbers for you straight off, so I want to set the record straight on that. So, and some of the confusion was, so for last year, non-trap harvest was 156, so people just hunting, but the total trap harvest was 846. Our averages throughout the years are more like 1,500 for the trap harvest and 260 for non-trap harvest. So that's the numbers you're talking about, that 1,500, 2,000 total taken through the state per year.
Okay, well, regardless of what we end up doing later on this cougar stuff, Dan, I hope you come back when they do open up that and bring up these same items again, and we'll see what, but we'll see what happens tonight from Iraq. Is there any other public comment from Bobcat? No further public comment. We'll close public comment and open it up discussion on Bobcat harvest recommendations.
I have a question on the cougars.
Okay.
Just, is there a mechanism to help with the collars? It seems kind of ridiculous to shoot a collared animal if you're trying to collect data.
So in the ochre study, those animals aren't, you're not allowed to remove those guys. But then the other side of it is if you're trying to monitor a population that's being hunted, you need to monitor a hunted population. So there are arguments for seeing what the impacts are and who's taken and who's not taken, if that makes sense.
So the purpose of the study might be to look at what proportion of the collared animals are taken by hunters. So you may want to leave that open.
Right.
Is that the purpose of that
study? There's a variety of, it's a demographic and population study. And we need to know what kills cougars. And you got to mark them first, and then that proportion is due to hunting take, that proportion is due to roadkill, that proportion is due to some other factors.
So that falls into the
falls, yes, that plan falls that right into the reason for the studies. Yeah, that needs to happen.
Yeah. So I guess it's an expensive part of the research.
I have a question for Dan. Your concern with so many females being taken, are the majority of lions that are hunted taken with hounds? And if so, isn't there a level of responsibility placed on the houndsman and the hunter to not harvest the females?
Absolutely. And that's why I've driven all over the state tirelessly trying to educate the hunters not to take the females. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've been doing that since I was elected to the board in April, and I've gone almost every week somewhere to some community and met with the houndsmen because there is that part of the problem is you have men making their, or not necessarily men, but you have outfitters and guides making a living killing these animals, and they're making $4,500 to bring a hunter in and kill one of these, and so
I just think there's a level of responsibility on the houndsmen themselves to maybe educate the hunter previous to the hunt that they recommend not taking the females, and that would alleviate some of the overharvest of the females.
Absolutely, and we're doing all we can. We encourage them to take that voluntary because it's hard to identify a female. It's hard to identify. Sometimes there's no way to identify if she has a dependent kitten because they're dependent up to 6 months old. So, yeah, we're doing all we can. We just think that there are some things that can help us.
Okay. Thank you.
It would probably be good to clarify some of Dan's comments, too, on the percent females in the harvest and the performance targets. He kind of crossed a couple of things right there. When he was talking about 39% females in the harvest, he was talking about total females, which would include adult females and juveniles. But the performance target, we have three different ones based on a high, medium, or low level of harvest, and ranges from like 17% to 25% adult females. So it's a difference there. But typically with cougar biology, we're looking to try to have less than 40% total females in the harvest. So just to clarify.
Tell us what you think, Wayne. Tell us what you think.
Well, my own preference would be I would simply vote against bobcat hunting. I'm opposed to it. But if I were going to propose something, I would indeed propose a decrease by one in the permit this year.
Decrease of what?
One. In other words, they get right now it's three. And this would decrease it by one.
So to two permits per individual?
Two permits, yeah. I'll make that motion.
Okay, make it.
I mean, that is what the plan would actually suggest doing right now. So
that's your motion then, to reduce bobcat tags by one to
so
two per person.
Yeah.
Doesn't that just avail another person to get more tags? I mean, that's not really reducing the number of tags.
It may not change very much, because if you look at the number of bobcats that were killed against the number of permits that were issued, it's pretty small. So this is not a high success hunting proposal or trapping proposal.
Is there a cap on it, John?
Sorry?
Is there a cap on the total number of bobcat tags?
Or total number of tags, 4,600.
4,600. So if they reduce tags by one, just more bobcat trappers could possibly fill in and harvest the same number of cats, theoretically.
Generally, what you see happen is, instead of just having your dad get two tags, they'll have the mom get two tags and someone else get two tags.
That really doesn't do anything.
I know what you're saying, and I can see it, but it's easy for them to get around it.
Yeah. Probably better just to leave with three than a serious trapper, if you will. They'll do a better job than, I don't know. I think that's
going to track. We've got a motion on the floor. I guess we need a second to the motion if we're going to continue with that motion.
I'll second it so we can have discussion.
Okay. We have a motion from Wayne to reduce tag numbers by one to two per individual, seconded by Sue Bellagamba. All in favor of that motion?
No.
Opposed?
You know, one thing that was kind of interesting was I think during the general fur bearing discussion, probably a couple of years ago, and the trappers at the time that came in, almost all of the comments had to do with the fact that the experience and skill level of trappers had gone way down, and that was why they were not very successful. That's just my own sense is that, you know, you decrease that because that's what the plan says you should be doing, and it may or may not affect things, but if you don't do something, nothing's going to be affected. Might as well do it, I'd say. That's what the plan suggests.
John, for clarification, didn't we as a RAC review the bobcat so that you could go to three last year or this year? I can't remember which one it was, but we had to change something to allow it to last increase
year,
by one.
Yeah, and again, this is before my time, but I'm still learning fast. I mean, the way the plan is set up, and again, and I'll read this to clarify it. That is to maintain. If we're thinking of those performance variables, if you remember them again, maintain baseline management strategy if less than two variables are outside of the historic range, or return to baseline if less than two variables are outside of the historic range for two consecutive years. So you can consider that if less than two variables are outside of the range, and that's where we have right now, less than two are outside of the range, it would, and this is what they fixed last year, it would pop you right back to the six, right? So I'm trying to make that a little more clear. This is one of our clearest plans we have, too. And what that additional language did was really good, because it added that incremental that said if everything's going in the right direction, which means your management looks like it's working, stay the course, don't jump and say, oh, we've solved everything. So now we'll go to our second consecutive year and then see if things are still on course, and then that's probably when it would jump back up to six again. So as of right now, the way the plan would go, the plan recommends exactly what we recommended, or the plan states exactly what we recommended, but in the old days, before that last alteration to it, it would have jumped way up to six again. I'm sorry, but we're...
Yeah,
does that make sense?
The real question is, and this is a judgment call, is whether those movements are really adequate or really represent movement. You know, we've only got 2 years of statistics, and that's not good enough, and they're not big enough for me to say that those are moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I've got this that's been approved, and I can't just say this sucks and throw it out. So excuse me.
isn't the point right now as we were at three last year, and rather than jumping back up, we're going to stay at three for another year to see if the trend continues where we're at, rather than making any changes. So if we were to change it to two, we might also not be able to determine what's happening out there. So we're trying to stay at three to have some consistency for a couple of years.
Okay, so to get me back on track, we kind of had half a vote. And I'm gonna call for the vote one more time to get it clarified. We have the motion to decrease the number of tags per individual to two tags per individual from Wayne, seconded by Sue. All those in favor of the motion, raise your hand. All opposed.
There's,
I guess,
no,
she did, so I guess she
by
did.
By seconding it, it allowed us to have that discussion. Otherwise, we really couldn't have had that discussion.
Okay, died from, or failed to pass the motion.
Okay, I make a motion.
I second that.
We have a motion from Charlie to accept the division's recommendation for Bobcat Harvest as presented, seconded by Chris. All those in favor? Opposed? 5-1. Okay. Waterfowl guidebook rule. Blair, I don't believe we've had the pleasure of meeting you before. Welcome.
Thank you. So I'm Blair Stream. I'm the waterfowl coordinator for the Utah Division of Wildlife. And tonight I'll be presenting the waterfowl recommendations for the 2012-2013. In order to formulate our waterfowl recommendations, there's two important surveys that are conducted each year. And those are the habitat survey, which is an index to ponds, essentially a pond count in the prairie regions of the United States and Canada, as well as a waterfowl breeding population survey, and that's a pair count of all of our waterfowl species. And that's conducted each year and allows us to, or informs us as we do our recommendations for the Pacific Flyway, as well as in Utah. So just to brief you a little bit on the results of those two surveys, for the pond counts, this year as compared to 2011, we saw there were a lot fewer ponds in all the prairie areas that were surveyed. When you compare this to the long-term average, it's about, you know, a little bit higher in prairie Canada and about equal in the United States prairies. So overall, it's nothing to really be too concerned about. It's just that last year we had a really wet year, and this year was a lot drier. And so comparing the 2 years, it does show a little bit of a decline in the number of, amount of water that were in those areas. To give you an idea of where our waterfowl populations are standing, within Utah, we continue to have a lot of geese. Our numbers increased from last year as compared to this year. Compared that to our long-term average, we are down a little bit from where we have been in the past, but overall, it's nothing too significant. As far as the flyway, the Rocky Mountain population of geese are doing really well. Looking at our swan populations, we do a midwinter survey each year, and swans continue to rise, comparing that to last year's, whereas our long-term average, as well as the swans in Alaska, continue to increase as well, and so swans are doing really good. With our duck populations, there are several species in here I'd like to just briefly mention. Our mallard populations is probably the most significant population as far as us formulating our hunt recommendations each year. Based upon that mallard population is whether we'll have a conservative season, a moderate season, or a liberal season. So mallard populations continue to do well as opposed to last year, and they are above their long-term average. There's several species of waterfowl that we are concerned with on an annual basis. The first one of those is pintails. Pintail populations have been lower for some time now, and they were lower if you compare that to our last year numbers. That may be a little deceiving in that on drier years, pintails tend to go farther north to nest, and so a lot of those pintails may not have been detected this year. Where we had less water, they may have been farther north where fewer surveys were actually conducted. But overall, I mean, pintail numbers are down from where they have been historically. Canvasbacks continue to do well. Their numbers were similar to last year, but they are above their long-term average. Scop are a real success story. They continue to increase. A few years ago, we had some reductions in the scop bag, but those are on the rise, and they have allowed us to have a more liberal bag, which I'll discuss in a minute for the scop species. Redheads, which is another big waterfowl species here in our state, were similar to last year, but they are above their long-term average as well. So comparing the overall duck populations, they were up a little bit from last year, and to their long-term average, we are sitting really well for the overall duck numbers. Our season packages, like I said this is based upon the mallard populations. Within the Pacific flyway where we sit, our mallard numbers were really well, and so that allows us to have a liberal package. What the liberal package means is it allows us to have the maximum season possible allowed by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so that will allow us to have a 107-day waterfowl season this year with a maximum bag of 7 ducks per day. There are several limitations to several species. The pintail numbers, which were down, it allows us to have a 107-day season still, but only a bag of 2. Canvasback is a 107-day season with a bag of 1. And scop, which were reduced the last several years, were able to increase that to a 107-day season with a bag of 7. The frameworks for the waterfowl season this year, we're recommending that the opener for the duck, merganser, and coot season happen on October 6th and run through January 19th. For our bag limits, it'll be 7 per day with a total of 14 in possession. It allows us to only have 2 hen mallards, 2 pintails, 2 redheads, and 1 canvasback. The season for coots will be the same as the duck season and allow us to have 25 per day. The dart goose season in the northern zone will begin on October 6th and run to January 19th. Outside of that northern zone, it'll start on October 6th and run to October 18th, and we'll have a short little period there where it's closed. It'll resume on the 27th of October and run until January 27th.
Blair, wouldn't that out of the northern just be southern?
It's essentially that northern zone includes parts of Box Elder, Rich, Cache County. And so there are, I mean, it's just a tiny little proportion, mostly around the urban areas. The reason why it was created was to address the urban geese that live in town. As about the end of January, middle of January, those birds start to move out of town and try to establish nesting territories out in the marshes. So we've pushed that season back a little bit in those areas, just to allow us to try to focus on those birds and try to harvest them. So the dart goose, a bag is 3 and a possession is 6. In the northern zone for the light goose, it'll occur on October 27th and run to January 19th. And then there'll be a delay between there, and it'll resume on February 18th and run to March 10th. Outside of that zone, it'll occur on October 16th through January 19th, and then resume again on March 1st through the 10th. The light goose bag is 10 daily and a possession of 20. The snipe season will be the same as the general duck, coot, and merganser season. The bag will be 8 daily and 16 in possession. The swan season will begin on the opening day of the duck hunt and run until December 9th. And that season only occurs within the Great Salt Lake Hunt Unit area, which is in northern Utah, and there'll be a total of only 2,000 permits for that. Falconry season begins on October 6th and runs the 19th, same as most of the other seasons. And the bag is 3 or 6 in possession. We'll also have a waterfowl youth day, which is only for youth, which will be on September 22nd, which is 2 weeks before the opener of the duck season. Shooting hours, we do have several restrictions in several counties. These are all in northern Utah. It's in Box Elder, Salt Lake, Davis, Weber, and Cache County. Because of the high number of people we have hunting in those areas, we recommended it to open at 7:30, just so there's a little more light to avoid any potentially hazardous situations. The rest of the state will just be on the half hour before sunrise for the opener, and the rest of the season will be a half hour before sunrise and a half hour after sunset. One specific recommendation, which again addresses areas in the northern region, we've had a problem with an invasive plant species called Phragmites, and so in order to treat those, we try to burn off all the old dry residual vegetation so that we can spray the new shoots with herbicide. And if those closures do occur, we'll use the proper media outlets to try to advertise that and inform as many hunters as possible before those burns occur. And one other specific recommendation for the northern region, Antelope Island Causeway, which is a road that goes out to Antelope Island. We've had some issues in the past with conflicts between user groups, mostly people looking at birds along there, traveling to the island, and people hunting directly off of that causeway. In order to address those issues, we would like to establish a 600-foot buffer on both sides of the road, beginning at the fee booth, which is on the inland side, and running out to the island. And that'll just allow for a little more safety and people to actually enjoy that causeway and look at birds, but hunters can still hunt within that general area. So it was something that was worked on with the northern region, and they all came to a consensus on that. And those are the end of our recommendations.
Thanks, Blair. Any questions on the RAC? Any questions from the audience? Any comments from the audience on the waterfowl proclamation or guidebook? I mean, no comments from the public. We'll close it to the public and open it up to the RAC. Discussion, motion. Go ahead, Wayne.
Well, I'll make the motion that we accept the seasons and numbers as proposed.
Okay. Sir. Have a motion from Wayne to accept the waterfowl guidebook and rule as presented by the division and seconded by Charlie. All in favor? Unanimous. Before we adjourn, I kind of skipped over the cougar discussion. Is the RAC want to do anything in the way of a motion to the board?
Well, I'd like to make a motion that they at least address the GPS issue. I don't think they should be changing midstream. I mean, that's like not going to happen anyway. But it's a law enforcement tool. It's a biologist tool. It's something really good they can use, and it doesn't change the plan in any way, shape, or form.
Okay. We have a motion from Daryl to incorporate a mandatory GPS location on harvested cougars, seconded by Pam. All in favor? Unanimous. And I guess that's a motion to have the board consider opening that part up prior to when the next proclamation cycle comes out. Well, I guess with that, I'll take a motion to adjourn.
I'll make a motion to adjourn.